We'll hear arguments next in Robertson against Wegman. Yes, he was down. Another guy. Mr. Monroe, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. Pertinent facts of this case are not in dispute. The original plaintiff, Clay Shaw, filed suit under Section 1983 of the Civil Rights Act against Jim Garrison, then District Attorney of Orleans Parish, the state of Louisiana, and certain alleged co-conspirators, including Petitioner, a prominent New Orleans businessman. Plaintiff claimed violations of his constitutional rights in connection with the district attorney's prosecution of him for a New Orleans-based conspiracy to assassinate President Kennedy and the district attorney's subsequent attempt to prosecute Shaw for perjury. During the pendency of his civil rights action, Shaw died. He was a bachelor, leaving no spouse, child, parent, or sibling, but only a will, naming a friend as residuary legatee of his estate. The executor of Shaw's estate, the respondent here today, was permitted, over objections of defendants, to substitute himself as plaintiff. Defendants moved to dismiss the action because it did not survive Shaw's death under the law of Louisiana, under which law there is provision for survival of actions in favor of the stated familial beneficiaries only.
Is that because of the nature of the action, or does that apply across the board to any?
There is a distinction in the Louisiana law of survivorship between actions for damage to property as opposed to personal actions. As to all personal actions, Mr. Justice Rehnquist, the limitation as to the rights of the familial beneficiaries are in force. And the further basis, of course, of that motion to dismiss was that under Section 1988 of the Civil Rights Act, the law of Louisiana providing for the limited survivorship must be applied to this action. The district court denied defendants' motions, and on interlocutory appeal, the Fifth Circuit affirmed the district court's holding that a federal common law of absolute survivorship of Section 1983 actions should be formulated, since the state law, to which the federal courts must look under Section 1988, does not permit this action to survive and is therefore inconsistent with the purposes of the Civil Rights Act. Despite both courts' acknowledgement that the Civil Rights Act is entirely silent as to survivorship 1983 actions, this is a case which has been charged with considerable emotion, arising as it does from the assassination of a president of the United States and the subsequent prosecution by the district attorney of Orleans Parish of a well-known New Orleans businessman for his alleged role in the conspiracy, alleged conspiracy, to perpetrate that assassination. The extent of that emotion is perhaps reflected by the referral by the Court of Appeals and respondent to Shaw's injunction suit against the district attorney as constituting established facts in this case, although neither Petitioner Robertson nor Garrison's other co-defendants in the civil rights action were defendants in that injunction suit, and obviously any findings there could not be binding on them in this proceeding. And also by respondents' repeated references to the district court's characterization of the matter as one of the most bizarre episodes in American political and legal history, and the Court of Appeals' designation of the facts of this case as Kafkaesque, although this matter has been before both of those courts simply on defendants' motion to dismiss the complaint.
Are all the defendants still living?
All of the defendants are still living, yes, sir.
And is Mr. Garrison still the prosecutor?
No, sir, he is not. He's been in private practice for several years and is readying for a candidacy for the State Court of Appeal.
He was the only state agent sued, wasn't he?
There is one other
somebody else from his office. Somebody else from his office.
Alleged to be a member of his staff, Dr. Fatta. Yes, sir.
But your client is a private citizen.
That is correct, sir.
It is and was.
That's correct, sir. Especially in light of this emotional background of the case, the holding of the two lower courts refusing to apply the state law of survivorship to this case pursuant to Section 1988, since that law would not permit this action to continue, and instead fabricating out of new cloth a federal common law of absolute survivorship, brings to our mind the dissenting opinion of Mr. Chief Justice Burger in the Nixon case, when he said, Mr. Justice Holmes, speaking of the tendency of great cases like hard cases to make bad law, went on to observe the dangers inherent when some accident of immediate overwhelming interest appeals to the feelings and distorts the judgment. These immediate interests exercise a kind of hydraulic pressure which makes what previously seems clear seem doubtful, and before which even well-settled principles of law will bend. Petitioner is here today before this court seeking to neutralize the past hydraulic pressures in this case and to restore the settled principles of law which have been bent by the courts below. We may start, then, with the basic principle that there has never been any common law rule, federal or state, of survivorship of personal actions. Thus, we submit, survivorship of an action is quite different from the matter of recoverable damages, which was the question, we believe, sought to be presented to this court in Jones versus Hildebrandt, and as to which there have been established federal rules, which the federal courts have chosen to follow, rather than state rules, as was the case in the Third Circuit in Basista versus Ware. As to survivorship of actions, however, we iterate there has never been any such federal rule to be utilized. A further basic principle recognized by the Fifth Circuit in its earlier Brazier versus Cherry is that any amelioration of the harshness of the principle of abatement of actions upon death of the injured person must come from legislation. That is certainly as much an American rule as is the need for legislative authority for the award of attorney's fees, which was acknowledged by this court in Alyeska Pipeline Service Company versus Wilderness Society. Turning then to the Civil Rights Act, it also stands beyond question that Congress made no provision for survival of civil rights actions under 1983. Both courts below readily conceded that point, as have all courts, as far as we are aware, which have considered this question, and certainly this court in Moore versus County of Alameda also recognized the silence of Congress as to survivorship of 1983 actions. On the other hand, Congress did speak explicitly when it enacted 1988 to provide that when there is such a gap in the provisions of the Civil Rights Act, the common law, as modified and changed by the Constitution and the statutes of the state of the forum, so far as the same is not inconsistent with the Constitution and laws of the United States, shall be extended to and govern the cause. Thus, as the appellate courts in the Fourth Circuit in Dean versus Shira, the Fifth in the Brazier case, the Sixth in Hall versus Wooten, an opinion written by the present Solicitor General, and the Seventh in Spence versus Starris, have all recognized Congress, in enacting Section 1988 of the Civil Rights Act, has adopted the state law of the forum as the federal law, or federal common law of survivorship of civil rights action. Amicus, in its brief filed with the court, simply clouds the issue we submit by referring to choice of law rules, since they only apply when there is no such congressional mandate as Section 1988. This court so recognized in the Moore case when, in considering Section 1988, it said that this, meaning Moore, is a wholly different case from those in which, lacking any clear expression of congressional will, we have been called upon to decide whether it is appropriate to look to state law or to fashion a single federal rule in order to fill the interstices of federal law. The instant case we submit accordingly involves statutory interpretation and not choice of law rules. This court should cast aside these false issues which have been injected and follow, we submit, the clear language of 1988. The only qualification which Congress stated in that section was that the state law not be inconsistent with the Constitution and laws of the United States.
Suppose some state hasn't modified the common law at all. Then that's the end of the matter, I take it.
Mr. Justice White, we would submit so.
And that the common law rule just couldn't possibly violate this one proviso you just spoke of.
We submit, sir, that under the direct dictate of Congress in 1988, that law of the state would have to be applied, since the law is entirely silent as to survivorship. There is no rule at all to which the court can turn, and it's
the only
a matter
common, and the only common law the statute refers to is state common law.
Right. I would say so, sir.
And that, although I suppose that if the state by judicial decision changed the common law, it would be acceptable.
That is an interesting.
Do you have state common law in Louisiana?
No, sir.
I didn't think so.
So in Louisiana, would you say that only the common law rule could apply?
No, sir. Because I think you'd look to the the law of the state as enacted by the Constitution and statutes of that state.
Yes, sir. But if it. My brother White's question was, what if it is not changed by constitutional statute but by judicial decision in Louisiana? Then what do you do?
I would say, sir, that if that were the rule in Louisiana, I would think that under 1988 it would have to be applied.
Well, now which? The judicial decision or the... Is that it?
Yes, sir.
The law in Louisiana, however, and by whomever declared.
That's correct, sir.
But that's not what the statute says.
I believe so.
What it says is as modified and changed by the Constitution and statutes of the state wherein the court having jurisdiction is held.
Mr. Justice Brennan, I would assume, of course, that we would have the situation, say, in this case, that for whatever reason, the Supreme Court of Louisiana would reach a different interpretation of the Civil Code Article 2315 than has been the case to date. I would say then that if the highest court of the state, in construing or interpreting the law, whether it be common law
statute,
or statute, to say that there is no survivorship, whatever, I think
that would be a statutory change for purposes of 1980.
I would say so, sir.
Well, that would be the statute as construed by the highest court of the state.
Precisely, sir.
Otherwise, you would have one rule in Louisiana and another rule for the other 49 states, I presume.
Oh, I think that's quite possible. I think that is true.
That's
as far as I know, Mr. Justice Rehnquist, I readily concede, as far as I know, the survivorship law of Louisiana is the only one, only state in enacting qualifications to the survivorship rule which follows the federal pattern, which you find throughout the federal statutes, in designating familial beneficiaries who have that right. Now, there are some, I think, 22 states which have enacted...
Well, my question was directed more to the difference between the civil law, which I understand to obtain in Louisiana, and to depend entirely on code provision.
That's correct.
And the other 49 states, which have more or less of common law antecedents, and the idea of the seamless web where there is no statute, the common law presumably governs.
Yes, I understand. So that certainly would be, you would have to look at the statute law of Louisiana, the same extent. We submit that all of the courts, being in agreement that the Civil Rights Act is silent as to survivorship of 1983, and that there is a void in that respect, it runs counter to all basic tenets of logic to say that the Louisiana law providing for limited survivorship is inconsistent with that act. There cannot be any inconsistency with something which does not exist.
Do you think it would be wholly inappropriate to
absent 1988, to construe the statute as providing for survivorship?
Absent 1988, Mr. Justice White, I think you would bring into play those doctrines which Amicus discussed at considerable length in its brief about the Rules of Decision Act and the choice of law, which, of course, is being debated all the time and is causing this court and other federal courts considerable problem as to the choice of law and what law to apply. So I think absent 1988, this court and other federal courts would have to be guided by those principles. And that, of course, is one of the tenets we are holding forth today, that with 1988, that one must follow the dictate of Congress, and one does not look to the choice of law rules.
Well, of course, 1988 doesn't speak specifically of survivorship, does it?
No, sir. All gaps. And I think Congress was being all-encompassing.
Well, do we have to look, for example, to state law to determine the question of immunity of government officials under
Question of immunity, again, I think might be analogized.
It isn't mentioned in 1983.
No, sir, it isn't. But I think it may be analogized to my point about recoverable damages. There you already have a well-established body of law as to immunity. There is, I think, a common law, federal common law.
Well, that's federal law.
Yes, sir, federal law.
Common law.
So therefore, you do not have a void or a gap in the federal laws. Position.
You can't read that in 1983.
Yes, sir. I think you can, sir, Mr. Justice White, because the premise of 1980...
There are some things that you just construe into a statute.
No. 1983 starts off by saying, in effect, that when commands the courts to apply its jurisdiction under the Civil Rights Act in accordance with the federal law.
Well, it says laws.
Laws.
And you think that includes laws generally connotes written statutes?
Well, that would be
and
true.
And you think laws means and includes...
It has been interpreted by this court, I think, in immunity cases, as I recall.
I don't know if there was a...
I thought we had just said that the immunity under 1983 was a matter of construing 1983. It wasn't common law, just a matter of statutory construction.
Well, it could be approached from the matter of in construction of the statute. I think some of the cases would indicate to me that they considered that as being an existing rule of law.
Pearson against Ray didn't refer to 1988.
No, sir.
At all.
No, sir.
Didn't.
That's my point. I think that rightly or wrongly, I think that the courts have gone that way. Is my point, sir. We submit there is nothing in the legislative history of the Civil Rights Acts to support the proposition that when Congress enacted Section 1986 in 1866, or Section 1983 in 1871, that it intended that there should be an absolute survival of actions under the Civil Rights Acts. To the contrary, that the survivorship law of Louisiana is not inconsistent with the Civil Rights Acts, we feel is demonstrated by the action of Congress itself in 1871 in enacting Section 1986, when it rejected a Senate amendment and a subsequent committee version, both of which included a very broad, absolute survivorship of actions provision. Instead, 1986, as adopted by Congress, provided, as explained by Representative Shellabaga, the floor manager for the bill, for a limited survivorship of actions under both Sections 1986 and Section 1985, which are the sections of the Ku Klux Act specifically aimed at the acts of invidious discrimination of the Ku Klux Klan, which so often resulted ultimately in death, and which was certainly the prime motivation behind the enactment of the so-called Ku Klux Act in 1871. If the purpose and policy of Congress were in fact that regardless of the provisions of state law to be applied under 1988, there should be absolute survivorship of actions under 1983, it seems obvious to petitioner, at least, that Congress would have required the same result as to actions under Sections 1985 and 1986. However, again, Representative Shellabaga, recognizing that under common law, there is no survivorship of actions for a wrong to the deceased person, praised the limited survivorship clause of the amendment, which became Section 1986, and advised his colleagues in the House that it operates as to actions under Section 1985, which was Section 2 of the bill, as well as those under Section 1986, which was Section 3 of the bill. He went on to explain that that clause was, in his words, intended to secure it, that is, the right of action, to the family of the deceased, to the exclusion, for example, of the creditors, just as our statutes do in the case where death occurs from railroad negligence. If Congress had intended that there be all-encompassing, unlimited survivorship of Section 1983 actions, as the courts below have held, Congress would simply have so provided expressly. It's been asserted that the deterrence objective of the Civil Rights Act of 1871 requires rejection of the Louisiana law of limited survivorship. Here again, it is inconceivable to petitioner that any such objective of Congress was so strong as to permit the federal courts to refuse to apply, to comply with the dictates of 1988 to follow and apply this state law of survivorship, when Congress itself adopted 1986, in that section, a very similar limited survivorship of 1985 and 1986 actions. Certainly, any objective of deterrence which Congress had in mind would have been even stronger, we submit, with respect to the types of invidious class action embraced in those latter sections of the Act, than would be so as to merely the state action type of violation prescribed by Section 1983. The same analysis, it seems to us, is also appropriate with the argument of amicus that Louisiana's survival statute must be rejected as being inconsistent with the complete justice theme of the Civil Rights Act. In fact, not only does Section 1986 restrict survival to certain designated beneficiaries, but unlike the Louisiana statute, It goes further, and the Federal Act also limits those beneficiaries to a recovery of only $5,000. Thus, we submit Louisiana's statute cannot be said to be out of tune with the federal complete justice theme. Moreover, Louisiana's statute is entirely consistent with every other federal statute which has provided for survivorship. Thus, whether the injured party is a railroad worker, a seaman, the ward of the Admiralty, a longshoreman harbor worker, or one killed on the high seas, his action upon death survives only in favor of certain designated familial beneficiaries, not a friend remembered in decedent's will as residuary legatee. Congress has accordingly directed, we submit, the course of action to be followed by the federal courts in this action, and that is, fill the interstices of the federal statute with the state law of survivorship. Adopt as federal law, or federal common law, if one will, the Louisiana law of survivorship. Congress, having spoken as it did in Section 1988 with respect to adoption of state law, but having been otherwise entirely silent as to survivorship of Section 1983 actions, the view of this court in Alyeska as to award of attorney's fees in a civil rights action is appropriate here. That is, the Civil Rights Acts do not contain the necessary congressional authorization for the courts to formulate a federal common law of absolute survivorship. As this court said in Chevron Oil versus USON, interpreting a provision in the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act, very similar to Section 1988, Congress made clear provision for filling in the gaps in federal law. It did not intend that federal courts fill in those gaps by creating new federal common law. The several arguments advanced by respondent and amicus, as well as by the courts below, as to the need for uniform and absolute survivorship of civil rights actions are policy matters, we submit, which are properly addressed to Congress. It is respectfully submitted that the law of Louisiana as to survivorship of actions should have been followed and applied by the courts below to this action pursuant to Section 1988 of the Civil Rights Act, and that since plaintiff left none of the designated familial beneficiaries in whom this action could survive, this action should be dismissed.
Mr. Wegman.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. I would like to say at the outset, in response to Mr. Justice Rehnquist's question with respect to the fact that Louisiana has the civil law and not the common law, and the adoption by the courts of the state law, if the state law is hospitable to the plaintiff's action, that's of no consequence that we deal with the Louisiana Civil Code and that Article 2315 of the Code is our survival statute. All concerned agree that if you are going to interpret 1988 to mean that the state law must be applied, the statute that would be applied would be Article 2315 of the Civil Code, and the action of the plaintiff would abate. Very briefly stated, our position with respect to the application of the state law is that the state law applies solely and only if, through the application of the state law, the action will be allowed to survive, that any inhospitable state statute or state survival statute is not to be applied because of the very simple fact that the trend and the theory of the civil rights laws is for the actions to continue despite the fact of the death of the plaintiff.
Well, then you're not arguing based on 1988, because I don't see anything in there about trend or hospitable or that type of language.
Well, I don't think I have any doubt but to argue on the basis of 1988.
Well, I thought that in 1988, if you look at your own brief on page 6, the language of the statute, that it says, in effect, the common law as modified and changed by the Constitution and statutes of the state wherein the court having jurisdiction of such civil or criminal causes held, so far as the same is not inconsistent with the Constitution and laws of the United States, shall be applied. Don't you have to show that the Louisiana statute is inconsistent either with the Constitution of the United States or with a law of the United States?
Yes, sir, I agree with that. And this is exactly what Judge Wisdom did, Wisdom of the Fifth Circuit did in affirming the decision of the trial court.
Well, that may be a matter of opinion as to whether he did it or not. How would you do it?
I would do it in exactly the same fashion.
That it's inconsistent with 1983?
Yes, sir, because you will find that all of the circuits which have considered this question have applied the state law solely and only because that state law was hospitable to the action and allowed the action to continue. This is the only case which I have been able to locate in which the state law is inhospitable to the continuance of the plaintiff's claim, as a result of which the Fifth Circuit did not apply the Louisiana law.
How about upon statute of limitations?
You had one instance, I think it was the Lefton case, in which the state statute of limitations was 10 days. And the court refused to apply the state statute because they said that it was ridiculous. It was not anybody's intention to deprive a citizen of their rights through a 10-day statute of limitations.
But you've had other cases in which more normal statutes of limitations have been applied, haven't you?
The more normal statutes of limitations would be 1, 2, and perhaps 4 years, and they do vary from state to state.
And haven't those
but
been applied
here,
under
1980? We don't here have a question of the statute of limitations.
But why is
Shaw's case?
Why is survival different than statute of limitations if you're going to turn your argument on 1988?
Well, statute of limitations doesn't enter into this case because this case was filed before Shaw died. We don't have to contend with the statute of limitations.
Mr. Wagman, getting back to the other one, had there been filial descendants, the Louisiana statute would not have been inhospitable, would it?
No, sir, it would not have been.
So you're saying the statute is inhospitable because of the facts in a particular case?
Yes, we can say that. Yes, it's inhospitable because Shaw did not leave. Shaw was not married. Is he to be penalized because he didn't marry? Is he to be penalized because his parents died before him?
The statute didn't prevent him from getting married and didn't prevent him from leaving the heirs. I mean, the statute is inhospitable, to use your language, solely because there were no heirs.
Oh, there were heirs. He died testate. But there were no familial descendants, ascendants, or collaterals.
Well, you don't understand.
Required by Article
2315
of the Code.
About. And that is the reason. That
he did have a family. He did have some collaterals. He had some nephews and nieces who survived.
So the reason the statute is in trouble is because of him.
If I might finish it, if he had not died testate, but had died intestate, there were collaterals who were there to inherit the action.
Well, that's not before us, is it?
No, sir. But you're asking me about...
All I'm saying is you're saying because of the peculiar facts of this case, this statute is unconstitutional.
I don't say that the statute is unconstitutional.
Well, what do you say? You say it... You say it doesn't bar you.
I say it does not bar me from continuing.
And if it doesn't bar you, then by what right do you continue?
I continue because wearing my hat as executor of Clay Shaw's succession, I have been allowed by the trial court to substitute myself as a plaintiff in this damage suit. And the trial court, in a very well-reasoned opinion, affirmed by a second well-reasoned opinion, with no emotion in it, despite the remarks of petitioner to that effect, has held that because the Article 2315 of the Louisiana Code is inhospitable to the application of state law, that it doesn't apply. And we bring into play the federal common law, which Mr. Justice Stewart spoke of. And the appellate court, in its opinion, made the direct pronouncement to the effect that the federal common law is alive and well. And it is the federal common law which was applied both by the trial court as well as by the appellate court.
On your theory, if he had left this, his entire estate to Ford Foundation, let us say, your legal position would be the same, would it not?
Yes, sir, it would.
But are not survivorship concepts generally, although not strictly and literally, but generally based on some traceable connection between the decedent and the person
and the
who's going to survive?
Yes,
and
I
get the,
have to
get
agree
the
with
results
that.
Of it.
As a rule,
it's true in the FELA and the others, as has been argued.
Survivorship statutes, as a rule, are for the protection and the taking care of the descendants or the dependents of the individual who may have been injured or killed by virtue of the negligence of some third party. Ordinarily, that is the case. But as I said before, if Shaw had died intestate, there are nieces and nephews surviving him. They were beneficiaries in his will. But it so happens, as is so often the case in life, his closest friend was closer to him than those aunts, than those collaterals, aunts, uncles, nieces, and nephews.
Well, the law,
so he left his good friend, named his good friend as the residuary legatee, which is our Louisiana term, of his succession, one of the assets of which is this cause of action.
Mr. Wegeman, following up on the Chief Justice's question, supposing he left the will he did leave and had also been survived by a son, and in his will he said, I don't want my son to have any benefit from my estate. Who would have the, under your theory of the case, who would own the cause of action?
Well, your hypothetical is a little bit difficult to answer, Mr. Justice Stevens, because of the fact that in Louisiana we have what is known as the law of forced heirship, and I can only disinherit my descendants for the specific reasons which are enunciated in the code.
Well, say you had
in
those
our
reasons
succession
available.
Procedure.
Say those
and
reasons were available.
It's next to impossible.
Well, but see, it's theoretically possible, isn't it?
Theoretically, yes.
Now, which law would prevail?
From a practical standpoint,
the federal
no.
common law that I take it you say gives the right to the estate, or the Louisiana statute that says it goes to the son?
Well, I don't know that I...
Isn't that the kind of question
I don't know that I understand your question. You're saying assume that he had a son and he disinherited that son.
Or it may be just said in the will, I want this cause of action to be prosecuted by my estate. Not for the benefit of my son, but for the benefit of my collateral heirs. Under federal common law, would that wish prevail?
Yes, sir.
Even though under Louisiana law there was a son available who could claim under 1988 that...
Yes, sir. Assuming that he did comply with the requirements of the code in the disinheriting of the son. I have to make that assumption because we do have our law of forced heirship...
Or say my
which
son
we're very proud of and which is very difficult to avoid.
Well, the reason I asked the question, maybe that's an improbable hypothetical, but if we accept your theory of the case, and there are, I suppose there will be possibilities of conflict between the federal rule as to who should get the surviving cause of action and the state law. I mean, state law might provide, as I say, that the son gets the claim, and under your theory, as I understand it, goes to the estate.
Yes, because he died testate, and using your hypothet, he said, "I want this claim to be processed by my executor for the benefit of my residuary legatee."
And there's some kind of a federal basis for our doing this.
Well,
for giving preference to the estate over the person that the Louisiana statute says should have the case.
I think we're on a tangent because we're dealing.
Well, I'm just trying to figure out what kind of questions are around the corner if we accept your theory of the case. Because this is not the only case in which a plaintiff in a 1983 action is going to die, certainly.
I'm quite aware of that.
Does your theory of forced heirship apply where only a parent survives?
Yes, if the individual,
and a sibling?
The ascendant is a forced heir.
And a sibling also, if there's only a brother?
Sir?
And as I recall, your statute...
Collaterals are not forced heirs, no. Forced heirs are ascendants and descendants.
Well, suppose then a sibling survived.
Forced heir.
Forced heir.
We've not applied the case. What do you call administrator of a will in Louisiana? It's a funny name.
We call it a succession. We call it the succession of Clay L. Shaw. We do not refer to it as an estate. We do not have a final decree as you have in the common law states. We have what is known as a judgment of possession, recognizing the heirs as such and placing and putting them into possession of the decedent's succession, sometimes immediately, sometimes after administration, depending upon the size of the succession and the involvements in it.
Mr. Wagman, the Chief Justice asked you whether your position would be the same if the estate had been left to the Ford Foundation, and your answer was in the affirmative. I suppose it would be the same also if the entire state had been left to the Ku Klux Klan.
I'm afraid it would have been. It would be, yes.
I think it would have to be.
Yes, sir. I have to be consistent.
Yes.
It's of no consequence who the residuary legatee of the estate is, of the succession.
Would not precisely be compatible with
it. Make it even worse, Mr. Justice Powell. Supposing by some strange whim of fate, he had named the very nefarious Mr. Jim Garrison as his residuary legatee. My position would have to be the same. How?
Probably the plaintiff would have dismissed the lawsuit, though.
I'm afraid so. This plaintiff would have.
Yes. Mr. Wegman, let me go back to Mr. Justice Rehnquist's question about statutes of limitations. Now, I understand there's no limitations issue in this case, but your theory, as I understand it, is that you do not look to state law if the state law does not facilitate recovery.
Now, sometimes I was asked that question repeatedly in the circuit court when I argued this case, and one of the justices couldn't believe what my response was, because I think it is just that simple. And it's a simple proposition, as is stated by Professor Theus in this Louisiana Law Review article, which I cited to you, that if a state law allows the action to survive, it is hospitable, and the state law is applicable. If the state law abates the action, it is inhospitable, and it does not apply.
Well, but would you respond in terms of the statute of limitations? If an action is brought, say, 5 years after it accrued, and there's a 4-year state statute of limitations in the state, now that would tend to defeat the claim. And under 1988, I had thought we would then look at the state law to see if that statute of limitations applied. Would you agree that we look at the state law in that circumstance, or would you because it's not hospitable?
I'm sure you would.
You would look at it. Well, why do we look to state law and in limitation situations but not in abatement situations? That's what I don't understand.
I can only give you what I have read of the cases. And apparently the reasoning is that where the statute of limitations of the state is for a reasonable period of time, in Louisiana it's 1 year, in Mississippi, I believe it's 2 years. As I recall, over in Georgia, it's 4 years.
Well, but
the
then
courts
why don't
have
we apply
construed
the same
these
test
to be
abatement.
Reasonable periods of time.
But then why don't we apply the same test in abatement and say, is the state statute dealing with survivorship a reasonable statute? If it's something that says no civil rights action shall ever survive, why, we obviously wouldn't look to it.
Well,
but if it's a neutral...
I think I could best give you the appellate court's reasoning in that regard, and that was Judge Wisdom established a 3-step procedure which he said we should follow. He said, if is the Civil Rights Act deficient in furnishing a remedy for vindication? That's the first step. He said, then if the act is deficient, we look to state law. He then said, if state law is available, we must ensure that state law is not inconsistent with federal and constitutional law. Taking that three-step procedure, he held that there was a gap because 1980, the statute doesn't provide it for survival, a survival line. He said that it is deficient, and we looked then to the state law. But he said the state law is inconsistent because the theory of Congress in enacting the Civil Rights Acts was to see to it that the federally guaranteed rights of the citizen were protected.
Well, isn't the same reasoning applicable to my four-year statute of limitation? Precisely.
Well, I can only refer you to the Lefton case in which the statute of limitations was 10 days and the court said that was unreasonable.
Again, it has to be reasonable and neutral. We assume that. Well,
I'm injecting the reasonable in there.
But I mean, why doesn't your argument also say we won't apply a four-year statute of limitations? I just don't follow your reasoning. I mean, maybe I'm missing something.
Because the courts have said that we want this civil rights claim to go forward. I have this same problem. I didn't enjoin Garrison once. I sought to enjoin him twice. I sought to enjoin Garrison prior to the first trial. I was faced with Dombrowski. Dombrowski, this court said, applied only to the protection of my First Amendment rights. The trial court, in granting my temporary restraining order, adopted my argument. If the central government was here to protect my First Amendment rights, why wasn't it here to protect all of my federally guaranteed rights? My first injunction request was flatly denied. We went to trial. But then when this malicious district attorney came along subsequent to the trial of the case, we had a 40-day trial. We had a unanimous 12-man verdict of acquittal within less than an hour after a 40-day trial. On the very next working day, Garrison himself goes in and files a bill of information against Shaw, charging that he committed perjury when he took the witness stand to defend himself and testified that he did not know, had never seen, nor was he ever acquainted with Oswald. State court refused to suppress, refused to dismiss. I went into federal court and sought to gain an injunction. Fortunately, by this time, we had Younger versus Harris and Perez versus Ledesma, and I was able to convince the trial court that I had those special circumstances which would enable that court to enjoin that second state court criminal proceeding. And the verdict and the judgment of that trial court in that second injunction suit was maintained again by the Fifth Circuit, and this court refused writs. This is not the first time the Shaw cases have been before this court. After the first injunction suit was filed and denied, I filed a very substantial jurisdictional statement seeking relief from this court. I have been fighting this thing since March 1, 1967. And I say to this court that despite counsel's statements to the contrary, sure there's emotion. This man's federally guaranteed rights were maliciously violated. This man was used as nothing more than a conduit to an adversary proceeding for the trial of the Warren Commission report.
Even if we accept all that as totally true, it doesn't really reach the fundamental question in this case, does it?
Yes, it reaches it for the reason that the intent of Congress and the intent of the courts is
to prevent people like Garrison from misusing his public office, to stop conduct which is more similar to what we might term a police state than a democracy, and to protect those rights to the fullest extent even after the death of the plaintiff.
The voters of Louisiana have done something about that already, haven't they?
Fortunately, and they're going to have an opportunity to do something about it again, because now he's running for the bench. And God willing, he will be defeated as he was last time he ran for the bench. Now, I had a lovely argument outlined here for you, but I think that I have given you my position. Let me say one more thing. Counsel for the petitioner made mention of the fact that the findings of fact in the injunction suit, where the court specifically found that Shaw's constitutional rights had been violated, were not binding upon the defendants in this civil proceeding. Well, I'm not here asserting that they are that those findings are binding upon these defendants at this time. I am here telling the court that, in addition to the fact that you must take my complaint for the purposes of this appeal as being factually accurate in every respect, you have another basis for taking it as factually accurate and taking as a statement of fact the fact that Shaw's federally guaranteed rights were violated, because it has been judicially adjudicated that such is a fact. And I submit to you that it's a simple procedure. We can theorize, we can analyze, we can analogize. If the state statute allows the action to survive, the state statute is applied. And this is what the several circuits which have considered the question have done. The Seventh Circuit did it recently in Byrd versus Johnson, decided in December of 77. If the state statute is inhospitable, it does not apply. And we use this federal common law, which is alive and well. I submit to you.
And this Court of Appeals is the only one to have applied that second doctrine, isn't
it? So far as I know, yes, sir. Find that the state court, state law was inhospitable, and hence refused to apply the state law, and instead applied the federal common law. I submit that the petition should be denied.
Do you have anything further, Mr. Monroe?
We submit the matter to the police court.
Thank you, gentlemen. Case is submitted.